This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Everybody was very polite about it, but the hearing today in Congress over new financial regulations basically amounted to a turf war. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke on one side, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner going at it from the other. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Marketplace Whiteboard, videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. You can watch them anytime at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Welcome to a Friday afternoon, everybody. It is the 24th of July today. The president's plan to overhaul financial regulations has been grinding its way through Congress for a couple of months now. The process hasn't always been as neat and tidy as we learned back in civics class in high school, and the pattern did not change today. The heads of the four big financial regulators offered their input to the House Financial Services Committee on new regulations. What lawmakers saw instead was a good old-fashioned power struggle. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
The White House is proposing to give the Federal Reserve Board new authority to watch out for risks to the entire financial system. That's designed to fix the flaw where no one regulator had a comprehensive picture of the threats to the entire economy. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is fine with that.
When it comes to specific regulatory actions or supervisory judgments, collective decision-making can mean that nobody owns the decision and that the lines of responsibility and accountability are blurred.
But sitting next to Bernanke, the chairman of the FDIC, Sheila Bair, said it would be better to have a group of regulators meeting together to keep an eye on the entire system. She's also against another White House proposal, transferring oversight of bank products, now handled largely by the FDIC, to a new Consumer Financial Product Safety Commission.
I'm very concerned about taking examination and enforcement responsibility away from bank regulators. It would disrupt consumer protection oversight of banks, and it would fail to adequately address the current lack of non-bank supervision.
An anticipated debate over regulatory turf was cut short by a long set of floor votes, prompting the chairman to gavel the hearing to an early close. But before it was over, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was asked what he thought about the second guessing.
With great respect to the chairman and the other supervisors who are reluctant to do this, they are doing what they should, which is defend the traditional prerogatives of their agencies.
And it's through that prism, Geithner says, that lawmakers should consider the regulators' objections to change. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The federal government has been throwing its weight around in K-12 education for years, more so since the Bush administration launched No Child Left Behind. Now the Obama administration is throwing some very serious money around. The president announced a new program today called Race to the Top, more than $4 billion from the stimulus package. It'll go to states that take specific steps to improve public education. Not a dime goes to states that don't. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Using language that could have come out of a conservative think tank, President Obama today laid down a gauntlet to school officials across the country who want a shot at the money.
And rather than divvying it up and handing it out, we are letting states and school districts compete for it. That's how we can incentivize excellence and spur reform.
And the president acknowledged that not everybody will make the cut.
States that outperform the rest will be rewarded with a grant. Not every state will win, and not every school district will be happy with the results.
Many states will have to change laws and regulations to be eligible. That poses political challenges, especially with teachers' unions that oppose things like paying teachers more based on student scores. I reached Tennessee Education Commissioner Tim Webb in Washington after the president's speech. His state's already made many of the required changes.
The issue of fairness here, Mitchell, in my opinion, is the issue of fairness to all children. And if a state is not willing to step up to the plate, they need to be pushed and need to be driven.
Russ Whitehurst of the Brookings Institution headed research at the Department of Education. He says there's a rush to adopt the approved systems.
I think lots of states have signed on because they're afraid if they don't sign on, they'll be frozen out of the race to the top fund.
Analysts say there are still a lot of technical details to work out as states jump on board, like how to compare student performance in 50 different states and how to link individual student achievement to what a specific teacher does in the classroom. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a term that's been popping up in the financial press more and more lately. You've heard it here. High-frequency trading. Lots of buying and selling in microseconds. Speculation is that's one of the reasons Goldman Sachs posted such out-of-this-world profits last quarter, although Goldman does say, by the way, that high-frequency trades made up less than 1% of its revenue the first half of the year. But there is no question that the use of super-fast computers to make trades has been on the rise. So we asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to look into where that leaves small investors with regular computers.
High-frequency traders use computer programs to take advantage of the tiniest fluctuations in stock prices. They can send out millions of orders in the blink of an eye. It means there's almost always someone to trade with if you want to buy or sell a stock.
I like to think of them as the China of liquidity.
Jamie Selway is managing director of Whitecap Trading. Liquidity refers to that ability to buy or sell easily. Selway says just as China's low costs make some goods cheaper, high-frequency firms make trading cheaper.
On the flip side, maybe these cheaper providers take jobs, or maybe these cheaper providers put melamine in baby formula or lead and paint on toys.
Selway doesn't think high-speed traders are that toxic, but critics say the firms are notoriously secretive and their lightning-fast trades can leave slower investors, like maybe your mutual fund provider, out in the cold. Analysts say high-frequency firms represent anywhere from 40 to 70% of trading on a given day. James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown University. He says that leaves the market at risk of a high-tech meltdown.
The danger is, what if these computers misfire? So that suddenly something goes haywire. Unfortunately, our markets lack a shock absorber to protect us in that situation.
The risks have caught the attention of regulators. The SEC is looking into the potential dangers. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Overall, not much danger on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The federal minimum wage went up today. It was a 70-cent bump to $7.25 an hour. Workers at the bottom end of the pay scale in 31 states will be getting raises. The other 19 states already had minimums higher than the new federal standard. The increase had been in the works for a while. It's the last of a three-step adjustment that was started years ago. It just happens to be coming in the middle of the worst recession in 75 years, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Is this the best time or the worst time to raise the minimum wage? It depends on who you ask. Heidi Scherholz is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington.
What this will do is get additional wages to low-income families who will spend it in the economy and stimulate the economy. So this is actually perfect timing for this thing.
She says the wage hike could act as a stimulus package that doesn't require government spending.
We estimate that this increase, though modest, will actually give the economy a $5.5 billion boost.
Business groups are skeptical. Mark Friedman is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
I don't think you could find a worse time to do this. Businesses are struggling to stay afloat, and the idea of adding a wage burden to them at this moment could potentially be crushing.
Consider the effects on the owner of a local pizza parlor. That's the example used by Bill Dunkelberg, chief economist at the National Federation of Independent Business. A 70-cent increase in hourly pay for 10 minimum wage employees will cost an extra $14,000 a year.
Now, that's either going to come out of the profits earned by the owner, which typically isn't real high in the pizza joints, or it's going to be passed on to customers in the form of higher prices. When pizza prices go up, people buy less, and so somebody's going to lose a job.
More layoffs when unemployment is already close to 10% could slow a recovery. But studies suggest job losses will be small. Last year, the Journal of Labor Research found that a 10% increase in the minimum wage caused small businesses to reduce employment by around 1%. This time around, there may be even less damage. Employers have had 3 years to plan for this hike. Even workers who already earn more than the minimum wage could see a bump. For example, teachers' aides at one preschool in Boise, Idaho, currently make $8 an hour. To keep their wages one step above minimum, owner Scott McGavin plans to pay them more.
You know, we want to make sure that our people are paid competitively.
His business is struggling, so it won't be easy.
It might be a little bit of a challenge for us, but it's a small challenge relative to somebody who's making $8 an hour.
Finally, it's worth remembering that the first minimum wage took effect during even worse economic conditions in 1938 during the Great Depression. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
To find out what the minimum wage is where you live, take a look at the state-by-state list on our website. It's marketplace.org. I think it's fair to say the overall financial storyline changed a bit this week from fixing the economy to fixing health care. Of course, the president says you can't do the first without the second. He said so many, many times this week, including during a primetime news conference Wednesday night. Here to help us with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond is Megan McArdle with the Atlantic Magazine's Business Channel. Also, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Welcome back, you guys.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here, Kai.
Megan, let me go to you first and ask you whether the president did what he set out to do on Wednesday night, convince people that you got to fix healthcare to fix the economy.
I think that would have been pretty hard considering how few people watched it. If you look at the overnights from Nielsen, it was less than 18 million people who tuned in. So, no, I don't think that he convinced people because I think most people didn't pay attention. And when they did pay attention the next day, the headlines were dominated by his answer to a fairly silly question about the Henry Louis Gates issue, the arrest in Harvard. The race issue totally dominated the healthcare issue.
Right, and that Gates issue continues to play out today, and also Dancing with the Stars was on Fox, so people had other things to watch.
Lee, what about you? So you think you can dance?
Aren't they all the same? Lee, what about you?
Maybe many people didn't tune in, but for anybody who sat there and listened through the entire thing, distractions aside, I mean, the American healthcare system, you can't get much more complicated than that. And Obama's gift is really breaking big, complex things down into understandable English. And I really thought he did that. I thought he accomplished that. But I think what he's trying to do is really just a Sisyphean task to really push this plan when even in the most plain terms, it's still very confusing.
How do you reconcile, though, Megan, the issue that seems to be at the heart of this, which is fiscally conservative Democrats not really wanting to go along with the president and what he wants to do?
I think the problem is that for all that has been made about the 60-vote majority in the Senate and a very sizable majority in the House, the way that the Democrats got that majority was by electing conservative Democrats in mostly Republican districts. And those people don't have a lot to gain from voting for a health care plan. If they vote for it and it goes through, what's going to hit the American public first is the sticker shock. It's going to be the cost of the thing. Any benefits will come years later when the program's actually implemented. But by then, those legislators will probably have lost their jobs. So I think that he's got a big hurdle to cross with those blue dogs. And unless he figures out a way to buy off a lot of people, it's going to be really hard to get any sort of substantive reform passed.
Lee, let me ask you about that buying off part. How larded down will this bill that eventually comes to the floor be with things that are designed just to get it to pass?
The potential for that is pretty significant, especially since now we're not looking at passing this until the fall. So it can basically just kind of hang out there and twist in the wind while people ask and lobby for things. So there's obviously huge resistance, and that's going to be just a fact of this bill. Whether it gets passed even with all those is still a question.
Lee, what about the issue of what else we might not be able to do as we try to pay for health care reform?
That's a great question, and you know, especially in the wake of everything else that Obama's already passed through, including you know, the stimulus bill, the re-regulation of Wall Street. But I think it's important to remember that what makes up our deficit is legacy investments, things that were extensions of Bush policies, tax cuts. I mean, the deficit is not just the stimulus program. There's a lot of other things that go into it.
Megan, what about you on that?
Everyone agrees we can basically afford to run this pretty gigantic budget deficit for a year or two while we get the economy back on its feet. When you look out to 2018, though, you're still seeing gigantic budget deficits. Well, Iraq's supposed to be basically over by that point. We're supposed to have ended the Bush tax cuts and probably will end the Bush tax cuts, at least on the high earners. And we're still left with 6% of GDP, which is a higher deficit than anything Bush ever ran. So I think that Obama does have to take responsibility for what he's going to do to close that budget deficit. And it's not about the stimulus as much as it is about entitlement spending and the need to raise taxes on a broader class of people than simply the ultra-rich who are small in number and therefore sort of a safe target.
You know what's great about this week? We didn't talk about banks. We didn't talk about how the economy's doing. No green shoots. No nothing. Megan McArdle at the Atlantic Magazine's Business Channel. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, RNs in a recession.
They're taking up a lot of the hours. They're willing to do overtime. They're willing to work. I saw a nurse who would work six shifts, and when she wasn't there, she was probably working somewhere else.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 23 points today, a quarter of 1%, closed at 9,093. After 13 straight days in the money, the Nasdaq dipped 7 points today. It's about a third of 1%, ended things at 1965. The S&P 500 edged up 2 points, that's 0.3%, met the bell to finish at 979. For the week that was, the Dow climbed 4%, the Nasdaq charged up 4.2%, the S&P 500 rose 4.1%. Some blue chips had some disappointing earnings, and that affected things. Microsoft clicked down 8% today. Amazon hacked away more than 7%. American Express bumped up 0.2%. That despite declining profits. Bond prices were flat today. The yield on the 10-year T-note remained at 3.66%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department lets us know how many new homes were sold in June. A House committee holds a hearing titled Post-Katrina, What It Takes to Cut the Bureaucracy. And emergency and disaster response for animals is one of many topics covered at the annual conference on animal protection hosted by the Humane Society of the United States. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are a lot of reasons newspapers are on life support, but one of the big ones is that you can get almost all the news you want online for free. A lot of that theoretically free news comes courtesy of the Associated Press. Free for us to consume, of course, not so for the AP to produce. And that's why it won't be free too much longer. The AP says it has a new way to track its stories and monitor where they go on the internet. And once they know where those stories are, Well, you can imagine what comes next. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
The Associated Press calls itself the oldest and largest news organization in the world. It's that size and prominence that makes it especially vulnerable to internet pirating, says the AP's Jane Seagrave.
We've been concerned for a number of years that our content is being misappropriated by aggregators who are not paying for it.
The AP says those aggregators, like the Drudge Report, are costing it millions of dollars a year. Under the new plan, the AP will embed a tracking device in its stories so it can monitor who uses them and charge them a fee. Sri Srinivasan teaches digital media at Columbia University. He says all media are struggling to find an online business model that works.
People are paying for things online. They're just not necessarily paying for news online. It'll be important to get people to understand that there is a value in news.
There is value in the news, but not in the old model, says Jeff Jarvis, who runs the blog Buzz Machine.
The Associated Press is working on the now outmoded content economy, where you could take a piece of content, copy it, sell it, and make money. On the internet, all you need is one copy of anything. And it's the links to that content that give it value.
Jarvis says the AP is punishing itself. He says bloggers and others will just start linking to news sources that don't charge.
So I have to ask, you have a blog. Do you link to AP stories?
I did.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
This has been a busy week for Amazon. Their earnings report yesterday didn't quite meet expectations. Still, the company is doing well enough. It bought the online shoe store Zappos on Wednesday. But it's what Amazon did last week that's getting most of the buzz. Owners of Amazon's Kindle woke up last Thursday to find a few things missing from their e-book reader. Amazon had reached into their devices overnight and deleted copies of the George Orwell classics 1984 and Animal Farm. It did refund the purchase price, but Amazon says the books had been illegally offered for sale on its virtual store, and it was only trying to protect the rightful owner's copyright. The company has since promised to stop remotely deleting people's books. Commentator Farhad Manju doesn't expect that promise is going to be kept.
The worst thing about this story isn't Amazon's conduct. It's the company's technical capabilities. Now we know that Amazon can delete anything it wants from your electronic reader. That's an awesome power, and it's destined to be abused. Most of the ebooks, videos, and mobile apps that we buy online aren't really ours. All this media comes to us with digital strings that stretch back to a single decider, Amazon, Apple, or whomever else, because our devices are now connected to the internet. Many of these firms' contracts give them broad rights to remove any book, movie, or app that you've purchased at any time for any reason. But why stop there? If Apple or Amazon can decide to delete stuff you've legally purchased, then surely a court, or to channel Orwell, perhaps even a totalitarian regime, could force them to do the same. When books were banned in the past, governments could, at best, only block the sale of new copies. But in the digital era, they can go much further. So far, Amazon has only deleted books that were already available in print. But in our paperless future, when all books exist as files on servers, courts would have the power to make works vanish completely. With a simple ruling over a copyright dispute or a claim of libel, judges could simultaneously block the sale of new books and pull all current copies out of circulation. The power to delete your books, movies, and music remotely is a power no one should have. Here's one way around this. Don't buy a Kindle until Amazon updates its terms of service to prohibit remote deletions. Even better, the company ought to remove the technical capability to do so, making such a mass evisceration impossible in the event that a government compels it. But these problems are bigger than a few select companies. They stem from the legal system's inability to deal with tethered technology. What we really need are new laws, or else the future could look a lot like Orwell's 1984.
Farhad Manju is the technology columnist for Slate. You can send us your thoughts online as best. Our website is marketplace.org. Turn on the television set, you'll find two primetime shows dedicated to nurses. There are waiting lists all across the country to get into nursing programs. So why all the RN buzz? You've probably heard the stories about hospitals with nursing shortages and how nursing's a recession-proof job. As has been said many times, though, the rules in this recession are different. Kathy Duchon reports from Baltimore.
Nalini Narayan just graduated from the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. In her last few months of hospital rounds, she witnessed the surge of experienced nurses coming back to work.
They were taking up a lot of the hours. They're willing to do overtime. They're willing to work. I saw a nurse who would work six shifts, and when she wasn't there, she was probably working somewhere else. It was amazing.
A lot of people go into nursing for security. That was part of the draw for 32-year-old Narayan. The former filmmaker was told Hopkins nursing grads often got hired sight unseen. The reason? Hospitals desperately need nurses. Now Narayan doubts there ever was a nursing shortage.
I'm like, what shortage? I can't get a job. That's really the case. I'd cry, but I can't. I just want to laugh about it.
There are still job openings for nurses, but vacancy rates nationwide are lower than they've been for years, says Peter Bierhaus. The Vanderbilt University professor is lead author on a recent study of the nursing labor market. He says in the last 2 years, a record number of nurses have returned to full-time hospital work.
The numbers were absolutely beyond our comprehension.
Bierhaus says the reason experienced nurses are coming back has to do with family finances.
70% of nurses are married. When their spouses either lose their jobs or are worried that they might, then some RNs who are not working decide, aha, I need to pop back into this labor market. And others who may already be working but say part-time, they increase their hours of work.
That's the story with Cynthia Yates. She's been a nurse for 23 years. She's trying to rebuild her family savings, in part because of her fiancé's career.
He's in real estate. So one of us had to have a steady position.
Yates used to be a freelance nurse for the Greater Baltimore Medical Center. Better pay, more flexible hours than being on the hospital's payroll. But last summer, her hours started to get cut as staff nurses gobbled up the time. Yates says by fall, the situation got grim.
November, I got a total of 57 hours for the whole month. The economy has changed everything.
In March, Yates landed a permanent position in the hospital's employee health department. She likes the steady paycheck and benefits. Hospital administrators admit the nursing shortage they've been harping about has eased. The danger, they say, is that it's temporary. Here's Carmela Coyle. She leads the Maryland Hospital Association.
We know that we have a booming population, a sicker population, and not enough nurses to take care of it.
Coyle is emphatic that those experienced nurses who have stepped up their hours will cut back or retire when the recession ends. That's why hospitals nationwide continue to push nursing as a career.
The desire to better coordinate care, the desire to treat the chronically ill in new and better ways, prevention and wellness, all of those things require more nurses than we have available today.
And that's why Coyle says Maryland is the first state to launch a fundraising campaign for $20 million to get new nurses in the pipeline. In Baltimore, I'm Kathy Duchamp from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, an oldie but a goodie is back. Thanks to the Great Recession, Kmart is bringing back the Blue Light Special. No actual flashing blue light this time, though. Instead, it's going to be blue balloons and announcements every half hour telling shoppers where the bargains are. Call it a gimmick if you like, but it does have a certain retro charm to it, I think. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 23 points, a quarter of 1%. The Nasdaq fell 7 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, a quarter percent there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of this radio program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, those credit card fees, they cut deep.
This store alone pays over $28,000 in credit card fees. And for us, I mean, that would translate to hiring another person from the community.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll be back here Monday afternoon. Same bat time, same bat channel. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.